From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Anthony Cordesman, the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS. That's a prominent think tank here in Washington. And we're coming to you from CSIS headquarters in Washington. Anthony Cordesman has served as the director of the GulfNet Assessment Project and the Gulf in Transition Study. He is also the principal investigator of the CSIS Homeland Defense Project. Prior to his positions at CSIS, Anthony Cordesman has had a long and distinguished career in public service. He served as National Security Assistant to Senator John McCain of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He was a former Director of Intelligence Assessment in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And he has been visiting and lecturing in Asia since the 1960s. He serves as Senior Advisor to the U.S. Asia Institute. In addition, Anthony Cordesman has served in many other governmental positions, including at the U.S. Department of State, Department of Energy, and was Director of International Staff at NATO. We will talk with Anthony Cordesman about a variety of U.S. national security challenges in the wake of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's surprise visits to Iraq and Afghanistan. We will focus on U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, but also talk about the threats posed by Russia, as well as the so-called Islamic State. Anthony Cordesman, welcome to the program.
A pleasure.
Thanks again for hosting us here. First, let's talk about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan in the wake of Secretary of State Tillerson's visit. What is your understanding of President Trump's new strategy in Afghanistan, and do you think it effectively addresses the challenges we face there?
It has several elements. I think the one that is most obvious is the military one. And to some extent, it is a strategy which builds on ideas that the U.S. military had developed over the course of the period since U.S. forces left in 2014, and to some extent, even before. Too many of the Afghan forces had to be rushed into being. They were not properly trained or supported. There was no major air component that was really effective. They had problems in developing officers, combat capability, and basically the problem was that in sort of rushing out, the U.S. and the Allies did not create a strong train and assist mission. They did not provide for air power to back up the Afghan forces. There was no real advice of the combat units. And in the case of the critical counterterrorism forces, the support was simply too small to be fully effective. Now, the strategy that has been proposed by the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Mattis, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and General Mickelson, who's the commander in Afghanistan for U.S. and NATO forces, calls for all of these to be corrected. You've already seen a major air component added, with the U.S. providing the kind of precision strike air power that the Afghan Air Force will not be able to provide for years. You're calling for more train and assist personnel. This is several thousand, and a force that size would not be one that had great meaning. But a force that size can be enough advisors to get out into the combat units, go beyond the core and the rear level, work directly with inexperienced combat leaders. And historically, it is the forward mission that counts, not the mission in the rear. You're also going to boost the forces that help the elite counterterrorism elements in the Afghan military. These have had to be used almost as the sort of special forces in a very broad sense. And adding to them is going to be critical to give the Afghans the ability to deal with serious combat capability and to go on the offensive. So this is a very significant change in strategy, and it's backed by two other key elements. One is there's no time limit. The president has said support will be conditional on how well the Afghans perform, the honesty with which they use the resources, and these are critical changes. But you're not setting an artificial deadline. The second thing is they're conditions-based. You're not going to set arbitrary limits on the number of people. You're going to tailor the force to the need. Now, that's the military side. And at least within Afghanistan, it's likely to help move forward a strategy which is essentially one of protecting the population centers and fighting long enough to force the Taliban to eventually go to the bargaining table. The strategy that is far less clear is a strategy to deal with the civil side. And it sometimes is hard when you listen to all of the talk about aid to realize how serious the problem is. Afghanistan has one of the highest population growth rates in the world. More than 400,000 young Afghans have to find new jobs every year. Nobody has precise figures, but to put it in perspective, it's unlikely that the direct unemployment rate is under 30% of the workforce. It's also fairly clear that most of the people who are unemployed are young. So we're talking about youth unemployment perhaps at 40% or more. Any American can imagine what that really means. The poverty rate is really at the subsistence level. The malnutrition level for children is well in excess of 35%. When the troops went out, so did most of the aid personnel. So did most of the contracts. So did most of the modern sector of the economy, aside from narcotics. So you brought growth way down, and you created serious problems throughout the country. And then we have basically a government which is rated as one of the most corrupt and inept in the world. And not simply by some sort of outside organizations. This is the World Bank, groups which are very neutral in ranking this lack of competence. And it's a divided government. It's divided at the top between a chief executive and a president. But it's also divided in terms of power brokers. And a significant amount of the country is under the control of the Taliban. Now, that is the area where we, at least as yet, we do not seem to have a strategy. And one of the great questions is whether you can make things work with military solutions to a civil military problem.
Well, you have very eloquently painted the picture of what's going on in Afghanistan and outlined the deficiencies in the U.S. strategy with respect to the civil side. You also mentioned corruption, which is certainly a major problem, the unemployment. So how can we be successful if we don't have those components? And do you see any will on the part of the United States and allies to perhaps step up on that side of the equation?
Well, we have been pushing in some areas. We've been pushing for economic reform. And in theory, at least, we have done two things. One is demand that there be real accounting for the use of not only aid, but the Afghan budget. That people can know where the money's going and what it's buying, and it's being used honestly. The second is economic reform, and here President Ghani has a broad reform plan. And this will be something like the ninth reform plan since 2002, but this time the goal is they be held accountable. When we talk about a conditions-based strategy, the conditions are that it has to be implemented. Now, that is still more theory than practice, but at least you have some set of criteria. And up till now, we've had all kinds of promises, claims, statements about progress, almost all of which have been grossly exaggerated or false.
What about the role of Pakistan, Anthony Quartersman? Rex Tillerson also went to Islamabad to deliver a very strong message saying, stop funding or providing shelter to terrorist groups. We know that they do that. They say publicly, Islamabad, that we're with you. We want to see stability in Afghanistan. But how do you see that?
Well, we've been delivering strong messages since 2001. And it is a little like speaking harshly to a deaf child. You can be harsh. You probably aren't going to achieve any positive results. I think the problem here is, are we willing to exert some kind of leverage? Whether it is sanctions, whether it is reducing the aid, whether it is putting political pressure on Pakistan, the fact is that denial isn't enough. And the problem for Pakistan is not simply one of how they're dealing with Afghanistan, where for a long time they have seen Afghanistan as a potential threat from the rear, something India might use, a country that is arguing over its border with Pakistan. It is also the fact that Pakistan is not really doing all that well in fighting its own terrorist threat, has a weak government, which has its own corruption problems, and a weak economy. So we're dealing with a fragile state focused on India and on military threats, with a very strong equivalent of a military junta, and one that's very hard to pressure.
In the same context, Secretary Tillerson went to New Delhi. Again, seeing this problem in Afghanistan is part of a regional strategy. But how do you see India-Pakistan relations in the context of trying to stabilize Afghanistan? Do you see any breakthrough?
I think people constantly look for breakthroughs. But, you know, whenever you hear about a regional solution, it's probably safe to leave the room. After more than a quarter of a century of promises without progress, the real reason that Secretary Tillerson went to India is India is a key potential ally at a time the U.S. has questions about its relations with China. India is playing a constructive role in terms of aid to Afghanistan, but it also is competing with Pakistan by creating a road net on the eastern border of Iran to try to get to Central Asia and getting port access to Iranian ports. There is no simple set of relationships in this region. You don't have blacks and whites, just grays.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Anthony Cordesman. He's the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a big shout out to loyal listener Aminu Binji. He's from Funtua, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Anthony Cordesman, let's move on to other challenges in the region and in relation to Secretary of State Tillerson's visit. He also made a surprise visit to Iraq, and we have serious challenges there, notwithstanding the recent routing of the so-called Islamic State from Mosul. We also now have some confusion and rifts within the Kurdish region. We witnessed recently a referendum for independence that didn't sit well with the central government in Baghdad. Baghdad went into Kirkuk to try to take over Kirkuk, which was up until recently being run by the Kurds. So we have a complicated situation. How do you see progress in Iraq vis-a-vis U.S. national security interests?
Well, we need to be very careful. First, we did not rout ISIS. You had an agonizing process of defeats of ISIS. In the process, many of the cities and urban areas where that fighting took place suffered immense damage or were virtually destroyed. As yet, there's no clear plan for reconstruction. It's very hard for people to go back, and there's no surplus capacity to deal with them as refugees. You also have seen a lot of the fighters basically escape. And they are operating, in the case of Iraq, in a country which is not only divided between Kurd and the Arabs in the central government, but deeply divided between Sunni and Shiites, with large numbers of Iranian advisors and popular militias which have a strong Iranian influence. It's also a country that's effectively bankrupt, whose oil revenues have dropped more than 50%. Both as a result of fighting and the cuts in petroleum prices. And so this is a major challenge. Once again, we have had real success in reforming and improving the military capabilities of both the Kurdish forces and the government forces. But if they're going to fight each other, and if we see not only Kurdish and Arab fighting, but Sunni and Shiite fighting, that's a major problem, and one Iran may well be able to exploit. We don't have a clear plan to provide political unity. We have elections coming up, but we have no idea what's going to happen when they occur. We don't have an aid or an economic reform and development plan for which there's funding. So this is a country which is also very fragile. In addition, we not only have an Iranian problem, but Russia has attempted, at least, to become a significant arms seller and has succeeded. So we have a Russian problem. And then we have a Turkish problem because Turkey has put pressure on the Kurds in the north of Iraq and also has put pressure on the Iraqi government, while the various Arab countries to the south have to some extent recently reached out to Iraq, but they all have different interests. I think that we're talking about a three-dimensional chess game where we've made some successful initial moves against ISIS, and particularly the caliphate. But there are some things here that most Americans, I don't think, realize. One is that in this region, ISIS is only one of many terrorist and extremist threats, and it does not constitute some kind of majority of the terrorist threat. The other is that there's no way to separate Iraq and Syria. They have the same border. In some cases, they're the same forces involved. The sort of extremist elements that are non-ISIS in Iraq are limited, but the bulk of what once were Arab rebel forces that aren't ISIS in Syria are now linked to various Arab extremist movements, including Al-Qaeda. So we've defeated ISIS there. We've taken the caliphate center, its capital at Raqqa, away. But it's not a full defeat. Once again, many of the fighters survive. We have not created a significant Arab rebel force. If anything, it's been largely defeated by the Assad forces, which are backed by Russia, Iran, and the Hezbollah. And we are tied largely to a separate group of Kurds, which have a relatively radical, semi-Marxist, semi-Islamic ideology, and are fighting the Turks, which are a somewhat uncertain ally of the United States and NATO at the moment. And if you look at all of these forces and you realize you can't separate the Syrian game and the Turkish game, you get an idea of how complicated this is. And in this case, again, we do not have a civil strategy. If Iraq is bankrupt, Syria is a fraction of the economy it was when the civil war started. No one has yet created a plan to deal with humanitarian recovery, much less a return to development and stability. So the question in Syria, where we also have the same religious and sectarian differences, is how do you bring any stability to a country which is now dominated largely by the Assad faction, not a U.S.-backed faction, and impacts heavily on Iraq? And if this sounds confusing to most of your audience, it's confusing to everybody in the policy world as well, because there really aren't any good options. Just very difficult ones that are going to play out over time.
Well, just like with Afghanistan, you painted a bleak but a very complex and important picture that we need to know. At the same time, we have an administration that has not appointed senior diplomats in the State Department, for a better phrase, nation build or help on the aid side. So that complicates things as well. But back to Syria and the success in having, in a sense, liberated Raqqa from the grip of ISIS, you have said, and others have said as well, that this is just one side of the equation. President Trump also campaigned to defeat, or rather to deter, Iranian designs for regional hegemony. So how does he do that? How does this administration do that if they are not prepared to do more than just walk away after saying, well, look, we defeated ISIS in Raqqa?
I think first we have to be a little bit careful. I'm not sure anyone is prepared in the U.S. to take on the chore of rebuilding a Syria which is under Assad's control, heavy Russian influence, and heavy Iranian influence. It also is not a matter of aid in the classic sense. Aid is normally project aid, or it is aid in developing government capabilities. When it comes down to true economic reform, that is largely a matter of internal measures. And in this case, it isn't simply a matter of development. You have to find some kind of equity between these competing factions and convince all of them that they have a common interest.
Indeed. Well, actually, what I really meant to say was that it was more the strategy. In other words, if you have a U.S. administration that wants to thwart Iranian designs, but at the same time says we should be working with Russia in Syria, there's a contradiction. So the Russians are backing Bashar al-Assad, and so are the Iranians. So I guess that is what I meant. You know, how does this end, this Syrian tragedy?
Well, it doesn't end easily. First, the tragedy is largely a tragedy of the Assad regime. I think whatever the Russians and Iranians have done, it's not clear that Iran has sought hegemony as distinguished from influence. One problem that we tend to forget is the heritage here. Iran fought the Iran-Iraq War against Iraq for 8 years. It was the bloodiest war in the modern history of the Middle East. Iran arguably lost something on the order of 230,000 dead, probably something on the order of 370,000 injured. So yes, they have ambitions, but they're also acting defensively in an area which has been basically committed to one form of conflict or another since the late 1940s.
Anthony Cordesman, I'd like to get your quick answer with respect to the Trump administration's recent failure to certify the Iran nuclear deal. Was that a wise move, in your view, or not?
Well, first, it isn't clear what their strategy is going to be to follow up. But I would have to say that probably not. First, we got a great deal out of the agreement in implementing it, which meant Iran gave up most of its nuclear weapons production capabilities or ability potentially to develop them. Second, we've taken a posture where we don't have the support of our European allies, where Russia can exploit these divisions, and possibly this will lead it to be more supportive of Iran. And we're doing it at a time when there is no unity among the Arab states. In fact, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain have essentially embargoed Qatar, one of the key elements of the area. Now, the administration has tried to heal these differences, but we don't as yet have a clear forward strategy. We know what we're against, which is somewhat important, but it's even more important to know what you're for.
Do you see a connection between decertification of the Iran deal and U.S. strategy toward North Korea? How do you understand U.S. strategy to thwart North Korea's designs on nuclear weapons?
Well, once again, we have said a great deal about the potential use of military options. The president's advisors have talked about negotiations. He has not. I think that the problem we have here is the message that a country like North Korea may get from Iran is that even if you sign an arms control agreement, the U.S. is not going to accept it. And if that's true, what probably is a limited chance of dealing with North Korea anyway becomes almost negligible.
How do you see the rise of China? We just witnessed the Communist Party conference. Xi Jinping is more powerful than ever. To what extent can the United States work with China, and how willing are they, in your view, to work with us to thwart North Korea?
I think that what we would like, we're not going to get, to have China basically reject all ties to its key buffer in dealing with the United States and South Korea is not really realistic. They have cooperated in some important new ways, particularly in terms of coal and other trade. We do have positive sides. We also have negative ones. I think we, as Americans, have to get used to the fact we will both compete and cooperate with China indefinitely into the future. There was a brief moment in time when the collapse of the former Soviet Union almost made the United States the world's only superpower. Well, Russia has reemerged. China is emerging as a potential peer in economic terms, and we have all kinds of forces that put pressure on the U.S., not as peers, but very demanding pressure in other parts of the world. I think that if there was ever some prospect of the end of history, history has survived magnificently. It is just as tense and just as uncertain today as it was during the Cold War.
Speaking of the Cold War, what about the reemergence of Russia on the world stage, Russia's encroachment in Europe, its illegal annexation of Crimea, its destabilization of eastern Ukraine, and again, trying to destabilize the Baltics? How do you see the threat of Russia? And we haven't even mentioned their interference in European elections as well as the U.S. elections.
I think we have a leader in Russia today which makes it an ongoing competitor in military and political terms, in economic terms where possible. We have to face that. We have to revive NATO. We have to ensure that our alliances with Europe are strong enough to deter and resist Russia, and we have to face the fact that at least indefinitely in the future, Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's much weaker, much poorer, but it is a very serious military power, and we have to compete on that basis.
And finally, Anthony Cordesman, just a general question. I wonder if you could assess President Trump's handling of U.S. foreign policy in the year since his election last November.
I think that you have to look at some of his senior advisors and see a considerable cadre of strength. The National Security Advisor, his Chief of Staff, his Secretary of Defense, his Secretary of State. And this underlying continuity has been very, very important. In practice, however, some of the tactics that he uses, confronting, making very short, simple, dramatic statements, sometimes making these statements and reversing himself or not following up, these don't work in an international environment, although they might work in a real estate environment. And these have been a problem. It's not a matter of personal opinion. Virtually every survey of allied countries shows a significant deterioration in the American position, with the exception of a few Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia. And it shows even more uncertainty and doubt. It is, however, early in the administration in some ways. You have to remember that there was a time when people really raised serious questions about President Kennedy, and it took the Cuban Missile Crisis to really resolve that. So it's very easy in such a partisan climate as we have today to take very positive and very negative stands. It still may be a little early.
What do you think has happened to how the United States is perceived abroad since the year he was elected?
Well, we already know from quite a number of surveys that the American position has deteriorated and that there are more negatives, less positives, on a very broad basis. Exactly what that means is hard to say because China was going to be a rising power regardless. When you have a crisis in the Middle East and the U.S. is perceived as a senior power, people are going to blame the United States regardless. Again, I think there has been a deterioration, but I would not exaggerate its seriousness, and particularly I would not confuse the president's tweets with the president's foreign policy, particularly given his senior advisors.
Anthony Cordesman is the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Anthony Cordesman, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
A pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington thanks to Rebecca Ward and Gary Jaffe for their audio and visual production assistance. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.